Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman back to the airwaves to field all of your astronomy-related questions. He is one of the best-known and most widely read astronomers in the world. Bob writes for Astronomy Magazine. He is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. His most recent book, which is in paperback today and for the last couple of months, The Sun's Heartbeat, great read. Makes it very easy to understand some very complex things. Number to call here today is 1-800-348-2551. It's 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment on today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, and our producer, Patrick Donges, will come in about 20 after and 40 after and read some stuff from the social media. It's going to be a great show today because Bob and I have already had an enduring argument about the the nature of the universe, and the show hasn't even started yet. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Great to be here. Thanks, Ray.
So before we get to the phones, and there are already callers on the line, what's new? What's coming up? What's in your crosshairs?
Well, we're bringing groups of people down to Chile to see Comet Ison, which still looks on track to be a great comet starting in November. But before that, hey, here comes the solstice.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And then
Gonna go to Stonehenge for that?
Hey, that would be great.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do that sometime.
Oh, how they danced.
And then we have the supermoon coming up this weekend.
All right, now what is the supermoon?
Well, it so happens that the solstitial moon, the full moon closest to the solstice, mm-hmm. which happens Saturday night, Sunday morning, is going to be full on the same hour that the moon reaches the closest point to Earth of the whole year. So it's going to be the largest moon of the year happening the same hour it's full.
So now when you say the largest moon, I mean, we've all often had this conversation about the moon is the same at the horizon as it is up top, but it actually varies in size.
It actually varies in size because the moon has an elliptical orbit, so sometimes it comes closer, sometimes further. And a lot of people don't realize it, but its very orbital shape changes so that it's sometimes more round and sometimes gets stretched out so that it can come extra close.
Mm.
And that's what's going to happen now. We have the sun, the moon, and the earth lining up in a way, and that stretches out its orbit, so it's coming to the very near point or perigee point on the same hour that it's full. That'll happen just actually after the moon sets on Saturday night, or actually the first hours of Sunday morning. Still, that full moon on Saturday night will be unusually big. It's also going to be unusually amber, a true honeymoon.
Mm. So the difference between the smallest moon, the most distant moon, and the largest is about how much?
You know, you always really get to it. You get to it. You don't let me get away with with exaggerations. No, it's really good because you nail it. It's only a few percent, and can you notice the difference? Not really.
Okay.
But a bigger difference is the thing you mentioned, the moon illusion, that when the moon is low in the sky, it appears larger to everybody. And this is going to be also the lowest full moon of the year.
Oh.
So it is going to look big, partially because it's actually big and close to Earth, but also partially because it's low.
Well, it sounds spectacular. Of course, you know that means it'll be cloudy with drizzle.
Yeah.
But still.
Saturday, I think we're supposed to have a good weekend.
There's always hope for that. And this comet, they say, and of course they can be wrong and often are.
With comets, you're often wrong.
But I mean, they're saying one of the top in the last 50 years. I mean, one of the brightest, anyway.
We're hoping, because we're going to catch it first. We're going down Chile.
If
it holds together and doesn't get broken up by passing less than one sun width above the sun right at the day after Thanksgiving, then the first week of December, it ought to be spectacular. It'll still be very low and close to the sun in the sky, though, so it's going to be kind of a daytime object there. But every evening, it'll be further and further and further from the sun,
mm-hmm.
and it should be really great from here. You don't have to go to Chile then. We're only going to Chile because the skies are great, and that'll be early in November. It'll be before it really moves far into the northern sky.
Okay, and then, so when will we see it first, and how long, assuming all goes well and it doesn't break apart, when will we see it first, and how long will it hang in the sky here in this region?
Faintly in mid-November, more brightly when you get into later November. Unfortunately, the moon is going to be full then.
Okay.
Most brightly around Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. except it'll be very close to the sun then, but hopefully the tail will stretch away from the sun, and therefore that'll be the sight to see. And then in the first, especially week or even 2 weeks of December, it'll be right after sunset. The head will be right there low in the sky, close to the setting sun, right after the sun sets, but the tail should again be stretching up and away from the sunset.
And it'll be with us most of the night then, or at least part of it, right?
For part of the night. But by it's near Earth Pass, which is around Christmas, it'll be much more of the night. And by January, although it will have faded a lot by then, it'll be out all night long because it'll be right next to the North Star.
Wow. So in other words, Christmas time, if we have some clear skies and it hasn't broken apart, it might be nice to see.
Yeah.
Wow, very great. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, our guest. Let's go to the phones. Merle in Argyle, you're on.
Oh, thank you. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
My question is a simple question. What is light? And does it have energy?
Well, yes. Yes, light, that's a great question. What is light? And even now, it has different aspects to it. But the best way to think of it is, you could either think of it as a particle that weighs nothing, a photon.
But it has energy, so
yes,
it has mass then, right?
It doesn't have, this is a little tricky, doesn't have any rest mass, but it does have energy. And you're so right when you say it has energy, it has to have mass, because energy and mass have equivalency to each other, so it can have energy without mass. But because it's always moving and can't be stopped, it doesn't have any rest mass. And rest mass is important because when any object moves faster and faster, it increases its mass and therefore increases its energy, increases its kinetic energy. But with light, it's always traveling fast. It doesn't exist if it can be stopped. It disappears if it could be stopped.
Hmm.
And therefore, light always has an equivalent energy, even though it doesn't have any rest mass and therefore any energy in any mass in that sense.
So, what is it?
What is it? What is it? It's
a
pulse of
equals mc squared. Doesn't exist for light.
Well, of course it does. I mean,
it's part of the equation.
Now, as to what it is, the best way to think of it is a pulse of magnetism. And immediately followed by a pulse of electricity, and then a pulse of magnetism and a pulse of electricity, both of them pulsing or waving at right angles to each other. So they're at 90 degree angles from each other, waves of magnetism, waves of electricity. Each one produces the other, and that's why we could call it an electromagnetic wave.
Mm.
That's the best way to think of it.
Okay, very good. But photons, okay. But photons are particles.
You can think of it as a particle. I like to think of it as a particle when it hits something, and a wave when it's traveling in space.
Okay, so that's in a way sort of quantum. I mean, it changes.
The quantum laws apply to it.
Interesting. Let's go to Tony in North Adams. Tony, you got to turn your radio down just a little bit. Okay. All right. Well, this is not Tony. Are you there? Okay, forget about it. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. I should say that at the outset of the program, and I don't. You know what? There are people who are new, and they don't know. You got to turn your radio down when you call in. Hey,
we were talking about that, the loss of the Kepler and the search for life.
Oh, yes,
and aliens,
yes.
And all that.
All right,
kind of
so thing. That's how the argument started. And the number to call, by the way, 1-800-348-2551.
Wasn't a real argument.
No, it wasn't. But you were bitter and biting, and that's what we expect of you, Bob. So Kepler, this thing that they put up there, it's not really a telescope, is it? Is it a radio telescope?
No, Kepler looks for light changes on stars to see if there's a periodicity that would indicate planets passing in front of the stars, looking for planets in a different way than we have before. Previously, we've looked for shifts in a star's position.
Right.
In other words, you actually get a redshift or a Doppler shift because a planet going around a star is going to tug on it and make it oscillate. And then
right. If
those are periodic, we can infer the planet, how many planets and what their masses are and what their periods are. Kepler does a whole different thing. it assumes that if planets go around stars, some of them will be aligned. The solar system will just be aligned in just the right angle that there'll actually be the passage of a planet across the sun's
face. So is it
the
transit of Venus?
Exactly like that. Right. And it'll be tiny. It'll be only perhaps 1/1,000th of the star's light.
A tiny flicker.
For a brief period of time.
Yeah.
A few minutes, a few hours.
Yeah.
But then it'll repeat so regularly that we can nail down what's going on.
So what is it, an optical telescope, or is it a, how does it measure that?
It's doing it optically.
Okay.
And it's already found about 3,000 inferred planets by this method. And if that's the case, judging by the number of stars it searched, the extrapolation is that there must be 17 billion Earth-like planets, not just planets, but Earth-like planets just in our Milky Way galaxy. 17 billion Earths out there in the Milky Way galaxy. So for the people who are saying, oh, we're going to search for another Earth, forget it. It's already done. The 17 billion Earth-like planets. But then it brings up the thing, is the loss of Kepler, because now that it's lost a second reaction,
Oh, by the way, just explain. We got a minute, and then we'll go back into the implications of this, which is really what we were talking about before the show. But before we go to the break, explain to me what went wrong. Now there are four wheels on this thing that keep it aligned, and you need to have three to get meaningful data.
It's the equivalent of a gyroscope.
So how does it work?
Where you can't point, you know, in space, if you're going to figure out where you are or where you move from the last object, you've got to have a gyroscopic motion to have a stability in three axes, all 90 degrees.
So
from
up,
each
down,
other.
Yes, east, west.
That's right. It's like the equivalent of pitch, roll, and yaw.
Okay.
And if you don't have three of them, you're screwed. And now two of the four are apparently gone. And I don't know if they'll ever recover from that. But even if they don't, we've got enough data to already work on. And you still have to ask yourself the question that despite the media who are obsessed by this, what would we do with it?
Well, that's the question we'll talk about coming up. Bob Berman is our guest. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. He's got some interesting ideas. Hang in there.
Support for WAMC comes from Reform Pilates Studio, Saratoga Springs, teaching Ramona's Pilates, providing a fully equipped studio with Gratz apparatus, private and small group classes, reformyourbody.com. Chesterwood, Stockbridge, Massachusetts, presenting their annual Contemporary Sculpture Show featuring 26 artists. Benefit reception June 22nd from 5 to 8 p.m., chesterwood.org. The Blue Rock Restaurant, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Chef Chris Ramirez creating new American cuisine and handcrafted desserts. Wine and beer from local to worldwide. Live Jazz Fridays, thebluerockrestaurant.com. Subsidium Technologies, offering custom cloud connectivity, communications, and collaboration network services to clients globally. SubsidiumTech.com. And SPAC, presenting the Philadelphia Orchestra with conductor Stefan Denev and Gil Shaham performing Sibelius and Dvorak Wednesday, August 7th, sponsored by Behan Communications, SPAC.org.
Number to call on Vox Pop is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, astronomer extraordinaire, is our guest. And Bob and I were talking about the problems with Kepler before the show while the news was on. And I said, you know, I think it'll be a big game changer if and when life is confirmed out there, anywhere outside of this planet. And Bob said, so what? Why?
Well, because you hear that repeated all the time. NASA likes to say that if we ever discovered life elsewhere, nothing would be the same. Earth would never get over it. It would be the biggest discovery ever.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if it's true, because most people, they're interested in their lives. They don't particularly care about other life on the planet. There's millions of genera that haven't even been discovered, and those that have, most people aren't that interested. We're attracted to cute things like kittens and puppies or scary things, but
wow.
So far as fungi and stuff like that, okay, let me be specific about that. I'll support what I'm saying, Ray. I'll support what I'm saying. Some years back, Dan Golden, when he was head of NASA, assembled a team, and they were sure that they had discovered life on Mars. Because
I remember.
Antarctic meteorite that had crashed into the Antarctic 16,000 years ago after spending 13 million years in space, and it had on board fossilized bacteria.
Yeah.
Martian germs. The meteorite was called ALH84001. I still remember it after all these years. And here is the panel, and they announced they had found life on Mars.
Yeah.
And I waited to see what the reaction would be. And you know what it was? Nothing. At the office water cooler the next day, what my friends, what other people were talking about, nobody was saying to others, hey, did you hear they found life on Mars? Where was the excitement? Where was the game-changing discovery? You know why? Because it was, oh, these are just germs.
Well, they're fossils, for one thing. It wasn't life.
Yeah, but that would mean that if there's fossils, people should be excited about, hey, let's send a probe. Let's dig down. Maybe we could find real life.
Yeah.
But I don't think bacteria or pond scum, plant life, this kind of thing will excite people. And secondly, I asked you before the show began, do you think it's likely or not likely that there's life teeming out in the universe? And you said, oh, it's likely. Well, I think everybody assumes that at this point. So in what way would people be amazed if they get what they're expecting?
Well, whether Ray says it's likely and whether 18 billion other people say it's likely, you still need proof. Otherwise, for all we know, scientifically, we're alone.
True.
But by the same token, the excitement, the water cooler excitement, wouldn't necessarily exist if they found a microbe on one of the moons of Jupiter. But that, I believe, would change our view in a grand scale over time. It's like when they discovered that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe.
Yeah, but we assume that already. You could be right, but I think we already all assume that life teems out there. You know what would be more surprising, I think more shocking, is if we ever do drill down through Europa's ice and probe the oceans, if we find nothing. I think nothing is more exciting than finding life, because life is, I think, expected in the oceans of Europa, because they've had identical conditions to Earth, that is warm, salty water for billions of years, that have received comets with amino acids on them. Those are the conditions, the antecedent conditions for life on Earth. Europa has exactly the same thing. Then we'd have to ask ourselves, why here and not there? And now you've got the Bible people and the philosophers and all the people stepping in to try to answer that, and they'll answer that in their own, according to their own biases. If we do find simple life there, swimming or floating or even complex life there, then it becomes exciting, but kind of, oh yeah, of course, sure, that makes
sense. But then you can, then all those people who adhered to the Drake equation and back in the 60s who said, okay, life is teeming out there, here's the equation why. Well, it was all based on assumptions.
Yes.
But if there's one microbe out there, then the equation can A, be rewritten, and B, you've got a basis to believe, oh, well, there's a microbe here. Somewhere there's somebody a lot smarter than me walking around.
Which we assume anyway.
Isn't that the point, though? It's all about the person. It's all about what Bob thinks. Bob trying to figure out where his place in the universe is, although I suspect you know. But most of us don't know. And so I think that's what science is all about. I think it's actually looking out there to find out what's going on in here. And I think that's the basis of the search for life.
Well said. I'm already ready to take it to the next level. The first idea is that life will live on the surface of bodies in so-called Goldilocks zones or comfort zones.
Right, which they found at least a few of, right?
Right. Oh, we're finding
Kepler's,
them all over the place.
Yeah, they found a few.
I think the first leap is to say, no, let's not be so anthropomorphic and say it's got to be on the surface of a planet in a comfort zone. If we look at Europa and see a moon far outside the sun's comfort zone and that has life, now we don't have to look at comfort zones anywhere. We can assume that life can be anywhere. That's the first step. The second step is not to limit our definition of life. Is the universe synonymous with consciousness? Is there anything that is truly not life? What's the relationship between the living and the non-living? Are stones here on this planet, are they really not part of life being part of consciousness? Does anything exist outside of consciousness? I mean, you start to get to the really interesting questions, I think.
Yeah, I don't think you can go to Chile and find that out. All right, let's go to the phones, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Bernie in Albany, thanks for waiting. You're on.
and a good afternoon to you. How are you?
Good.
I have two questions, totally unrelated to each other. Number one is, what is the relationship between a field, a wave, and a particle? And question number two concerns the moon. Is it heating up, cooling down, or remaining the same temperature internally?
Okay, let's do the first one. Waves, fields, and particles. Well, a field is a... is an energy matrix. We can have magnetic fields and electric fields that can impart their characteristics on other energies or particles that move through it. A wave and a particle, we now know, are interrelated. Whether it's light or even an electron, we've now find that particles have energy or wave-like properties, and it all depends on the experiment we do. If we look for a particle aspect of light or electron or solid particles, we'll see it as a particle. If we do an experiment, so we'll look to see whether it's a wave, we find that it's a wave. So the distinction between these that you mentioned are really going away, because energy and mass, waves and particles, we're finding are two faces of the same thing. Now, the moon. What's happening to the moon? Well, we think that after the birth of the solar system, all the objects in the solar system are generally cooling off, unless they have a translation of gravitational energy into heat, which can happen if it's slowly shrinking. And the giant planets, if they're even shrinking slightly, they can gain heat as they shrink. Or, and if they have the decay of nuclear products, for example, in Earth's core, the core is probably kept hot because of the simple decay of uranium with its 4.5 billion year lifespan as uranium turns into lead. So that keeps the Earth's core hot. The moon doesn't have a hot core. It has a solid core, like a crystalline core. We found that because every time it's struck by something, it rings like a gong. It goes boing, 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 and shakes for 2.5 hours after it's struck, which Earth doesn't do, which proves that the moon has a solid, almost crystalline type core. So it's already cold, and it will only get colder with time. Also, it's spiraling away from Earth. It's leaving us, and so it's going to have a little less influence in the Earth-moon system between the two. So I hope that answers both.
Bernie, thanks a lot for the call. You know, you brought up the moon and it being struck. I don't know if it was last month or a month or two ago, one of the brightest flashes ever seen on the moon.
Yeah, that was cool. We did a show on that and SLU to look at that same part of the moon, Mare Imbrium, which got hit. It produced a fourth magnitude flash of light. It was the biggest impact ever detected on the moon. And it happened last March 17th. We've had a NASA program in place now for the last 8 years looking for impacts on the moon.
Yeah.
And in those 8 years, the biggest by far happened this past March 17th. Turns out the object was probably only about a foot across, probably weighed about 50 pounds, but was going 54,000 miles an hour. So it delivered all of its impact force. In other words, the kinetic energy was released all of a sudden to this one little spot on the moon, probably created a crater 60 feet across, about the size of a house plus a small front yard. And it'll be interesting if we pass over the moon and can detect this fresh crater that was never there before.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551, and it's Tom in Catskill. Your turn. You're on, Tom.
Okay, thank you, Ray. I wanted to ask if you are aware of or you've ever read a book called The Holographic Nature of the Universe.
I have not read that book. Tell me about it. And in what sense is the universe holographic?
That's what I was going to ask you to explain to me.
Well, here's the thing. We of course apply our human associations to stuff. We've always been doing this. We've been doing this for centuries. We did music of the spheres. We applied geometric shapes to each one of the planets' orbits. Holst's dreary composition, the planets, you know, if you've ever listened to that, it's pretty structured, it's pretty uninspiring, and one of the reasons is that the actual universe is pretty free-flowing and goes boo at every turn, whereas our associations tend to be intellectual and predictable and plotting. So in all the ways we try to superimpose our anthropomorphic takes on the cosmos. It's kind of like grasping water and it flows through our hands. So this author's idea was the universe is like a, and then you always fill out that sentence with some idea you
it's
have.
It's like a Mad Lib.
It's like a hologram. Some say it's like, are there different brains, that is membranes that are coming together? Are there multiverses? Are there different universes? And then as you go through the Big Bang, previous to the Big Bang, there are other universes with different properties. Some are fascinated by these, but absent any hard data, and my friend Tarun Biswas, a professor at SUNY New Paltz, throws up his hands in the air to his students, and I think he's absolutely right, because unless you can prove, unless you have some testing going on or some observation or can support it, it just becomes more mental stuff, and every few years it's replaced by other, I won't even call them hypotheses, other associative ideas, and we'd like to see a little bit more meat.
Let me just ask you one question, because I think this is partially the idea of the holographic nature of the universe.
Go ahead.
Okay, let's just say all intelligent life in the entire universe all comes to a total end at the same time, okay? Would three-dimensionality continue to exist with no intelligence whatsoever to perceive it?
Three-dimensionality, in other words, would there be a universe if there were no conscious beings?
Exactly. Would the universe even exist at all if there was no intelligent life whatsoever?
This goes back to sort of what we were saying before. Is consciousness or conscious beings necessary for existence? In other words, is awareness and the universe, is nature and the observer correlative? Are they part of a single entity? We know that there are no colors in the universe unless there's an observer. Colors don't exist. We know that the stars are not bright. The sun isn't bright. There's no brightness out there. We bring it into existence. All there are pulses of magnetism and electricity, which are invisible. It's an invisible universe, invisible. And that observers change it into a universe with light and shapes and colors and forms and sounds. So we're as necessary to all these things as the physical phenomena are. So the question you're kind of asking, which is a great one, is to how does this extend? Does this extend all the way so that indeed observers and the universe are absolutely necessary for each other and you can't take one away without the other? I think it's a great point.
I think it's a great call. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ray.
Have a good one. Well, you see, we've done it again. 1-800-348-2551. We've hit that metaphysical realm. Andre in Williamstown, you're on.
Good afternoon, folks. How are you?
Good.
I'd like to just build on what Tom was saying, because that was sort of what I wanted to add to the discussion. My girlfriend and I were out walking in the woods over the weekend, and we noticed a lot of trees that had fallen because of the recent storms, and, you know, the earth had been pulled up. And I said, would there be a sound here if no one was here to hear the falling of the tree?
What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm siding on what Bob is saying about consciousness being, you know, what is there and what is absolute, and everything else that we see and we experience really is we, you know, as consciousness, we get to experience it. So without the consciousness, there is nothing.
Well, absolutely right. And this is a particularly easy example, the one that you've mentioned, the tree falling, because it just so happens that sound is a series of rapid pulsations of air pressure, changes in air pressure that are only perceived as sound if they happen between 20 times and 20,000 times a second. People who are in the business of audio or radio know that 20 to 20,000. That's what you know. Good headphones show. If there are fewer
but good ones.
If there are fewer pulses than that, you just feel it as a little wind. And if there are more pulses than that, it's also a little wind, but it's certainly not sound. So you need a conscious observer for there to be sound. Without the conscious observer, obviously there's no sound. The most you could say, even if the other things were in existence without an observer, which is sort of what the other caller was bringing up, even if it was in existence, at most it would be changes of air pressure, but not sound.
Sure. So, Bob, you are a man of science. you explore things in the physical universe, per se, but I also sense from you that you also explore the inner universe as well. Is that correct?
I always try to evade questions like
aha.
that, only because, and Ray's going, aha, because, you know, I have this microphone in front of me, and of course I would love to give the world my wisdom and my metaphysical.
Hang on, let me light the incense. Go ahead.
Right, that's right, and tell people exactly how it is in terms of philosophy and religion and all the rest. But I think it's kind of unfair, because I'm sitting here because of it's a science show, and even if I'm asked directly the way you kindly did, it's sort of like unfair for me to go out on a tangent and tell people how I feel the other ways. You hear what I'm saying?
I do, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
So, but surely, you know, whether or not it takes a person to understand, to hear the sound for there to be sound, which I get, surely the laws of physics, speed of light, everything else, go beyond. We don't have to be there to measure that, right? In other words, they are what they are, or am I wrong?
Well, they are what they are, but let's see what the they is. We've already seen, and here there's no argument, I know from you, Ray, that you can't have brightness, you can't have color, you can't have sights without an
right.
observer. You can't have sounds without the observer. Now, can you have the objects themselves? Now, this is where we really get into the quantum world and get really tricky, because the double slit experiment and others
right.
show that the observer changes what's being seen. Now, everything is made, of course, of atoms, shimmering atoms, and the atoms are made of subatomic particles. Now, each of them seems to have a position and a motion that depends on the observer. Absent the observer, each subatomic particle seems to be in a shimmering state of probability. This is all the work of John Bell from the 60s.
Yeah.
And this is science, not
right.
metaphysics,
right.
that showed us that only upon observation does this probabilistic blurry state of objects collapse. In other words, the right term is saying the wave function collapses so that there is a real object in a real position. So others, we've even had Nobel Prize winning physicist John Wheeler, who argued that in what became known as the anthropomorphic principle, that absent an observation, we can't really be sure, and it may not be that the object is actually there unless it's being observed. He would say that an object is not a real object unless it's an observed object. Now, I know this gets far out and people can argue it, and I'm not even going to argue it too strenuously.
Okay, I'm not going to argue with you.
But it just takes it further, what you're saying. What actually would be there absent any observers? And it's really an interesting, a fascinating topic.
You ever notice how many times we get in to this from astronomy?
Well,
you know, we try to talk about the moon and the comets.
I know, it was that caller who did it.
All right, let's take a break. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest. We hit the home stretch coming up. Give us a call if you wish. 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Unison Arts Center, New Paltz. The Mohonk Mountain Stage presents Other Desert Cities, a contemporary comedy directed by Robert Miller. It's Fridays and Saturdays, June 21st through 29th, unisonarts.org. Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available, thedamcafeanddeli.com. Skidmore College Master's Program, offering individualized graduate studies in a wide range of interdisciplinary fields. Masters at skidmore.edu. Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York, offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975, including independent living and more, caring in the family tradition, 518-393-8800. M. Proctor is presenting the Cole Porter musical comedy Anything Goes, featuring Broadway actress Rachel York, July 9th through 14th, proctors.org.
Let's wait for the guitar solo here. Bob is going to try to tell me who did this song. It's from 1973. All right, Bob, listen closely. I'll give you a hint. Larry Carlton is on the guitar. The Crusaders, right? the Crusaders?
Yeah.
Been to a cocktail party or two back in the 70s? The lava lamps, the Crusaders?
I was doing lava lamps, not cocktail parties.
All right, fair enough. Well, there's parties, let's call them that. Back to the phones we go at 1-800-348-2551. Well, let's go to the phones after our screener takes some of the calls when he's done texting. So anyway, we're getting into consciousness, and let's go to Carl in Palatine. Carl, you're on.
Hi. The dim light bulb in my little mind finally went off after several years when it occurred to me, and I must have been doing some deep thinking about cosmology or astronomy while watching an NBA basketball game. Dim light bulb went off. I finally think I understand what Bob Berman has been trying to teach about when he answers questions like my 15 questions over the years about, you know, what comes after the end of the universe. Rather, what occurs to me, and correct me please, is that we cannot see a definition of a universe. We cannot do that because we are part of it. And that old business about the balloon with the spots on it spreading apart and the universe expanding finally makes sense if I can understand that I am part of something which I cannot see any borders to.
You got all this from watching the basketball game?
That's when the light bulb went off.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Well, what do you think?
I forgot the score of the basketball game.
Well, I believe the Spurs won. So go ahead, Bob. You want to comment on that?
Well, a few different things were brought up. The expanding dots on the balloon is a common way people try to picture the expanding universe. And what I always say is that the common question, which is what is the universe expanding into, is a non-existent question. It seems like a real question because we're picturing the universe expanding as if it were a balloon, but we're picturing it as if we were outside of it, watching it expand. And there's no such perspective because the universe, by definition, is everything there is, and you can't be outside of everything there is. So let's take away that perspective.
Okay.
and just get to what we can picture. And what we can picture is what we see, which is we're inside a cluster of galaxies. All the others are moving away from ours. And that makes sense. And we just have to accept that no matter where we were in the universe, we would see all other clusters of galaxies expanding away from ours. That's the reality. Everybody can picture that, and then there's no problem with it. It's only when we try to get bigger and step outside of the whole shebang that you run into trouble.
Okay, thanks, Carl. Let's go to Nia in East Hoosick. Nia, you're on with Bob Berman.
Yeah, hi, the Bob and Ray Show.
Hello.
Hi, I want to talk more about this object and bat this idea around with both of you, particularly Bob in this case, about the object and the observer. So first I want to make a statement, and then I'd like you to talk about this theory of, or not just theory, but I'd like to hear the precise details of that the thinking is of how an object changes when an observer is looking. But I'd like to make my comment first.
Okay.
I fail completely to see, or to put it another way, objects exist without being observed. We can observe the fact that we can look into the past in many different ways scientifically, and say, all right, we were observing that, but we weren't there to observe it then, but it still was going on, and we talk about that scientifically, whether it's naming the ages of the Earth or talking about the stars and so forth. Things don't cease to exist because we are not looking at them, and then you say, well, how do you know that? Well, I've given a kind of proof of that, in essence, by the statement that I made. However, if you want to be more simple about it, more in the present instant, you know that if X observer is taken away from, for instance, looking at a tree or a star or whatever, those things do not cease to exist. So I fail completely to understand the logic of that. And that, so if you could answer that and answer it by talking about the observer and the object, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Now, of course, Einstein, you told me during the break, had some of these same questions with his buddies who said, hey, wait a minute, the moon is gone when you're not looking
at it. That's right. A lot of Einstein's friends said the same thing. The object is not there. The observer is required for the object. And that's becoming more and more kind of a standard thinking in science. What our caller is looking at it the old way, and I can't blame her for doing that because it's certainly more logical. When we get to the new way, things like quantum mechanics, we get to things that are non-logical. It's not that they're anti-logical, they're non-logical. For example, we have objects in superposition. A state of superposition
what is that?
Means that all the choices we can think of don't apply. And we say, how can that be? It's outside logic. For example, if you wondered where your cat was, and
right.
you knew it was in the house, you could say it's either in the living room or it's not in the living room. Maybe there's a third choice. Maybe it's partially. It's
right.
sleeping in the right between them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of any other choices that it's in the living room or not in the living room or partially in the living room? I can't. There are no other choices. But when it comes to the world of quantum mechanics, we have phenomena that are behaving in ways that it shows is outside our ability to think of it or conceive of it. Now, similarly, the caller very reasonably is saying, how can something exist? If nobody's there, the tree is still there. The next person who comes back will see the tree pretty much the same way. It's at least it doesn't behave like rainbows, which look like they're there, but they really aren't.
Right.
You know, rainbow doesn't exist. It doesn't cast a shadow. It doesn't have a reflection. You can't see a rainbow and its reflection. There are some objects.
But you can take a picture of it.
If you take a picture of it, then that's not the rainbow you're seeing. It's a picture that's a different rainbow.
Ah,
clever man. So these things that the likes of John Bell and John Wheeler and all the rest of them are saying are not really that amenable to logic. The more you can grasp it to a certain point and it makes its own sense in a certain way, but there's always people who can say, well, hey, come on, even if somebody dies, the world carries on. Because some of these things lead towards solipsism, which is essentially a oneness of everything. And you start to get almost Buddhist, Hindu, metaphysical with it. And it's sort of, unless we devote a whole show to it, I don't think we
can. Hell, let's do a whole series. You barely scratch the surface. All right, well, this is all very interesting. Well, I'm sorry, the topic is astronomy here. Let's go to Chris in Altona. Chris, you're on.
Thank you. I hope I can make my question logical. I've read in the press about a particle that now can travel up to 60 miles and be perceived on the other side of this expanse, but it does not exist in between. It involves entanglement theory and, I guess, quantum mechanics.
Are you talking about quantum tunneling?
I guess so.
Oh, boy.
And it's just like, wow, what is this? Like a group of pigeons leave their roost in the morning, scatter all around, and then coalesce back at the same place, or say at another island in the evening.
it's a whole other world. It's really outside my field, particle physics.
Yeah.
We've known now for some years that neutrinos, which are the most common particle in the universe, they're everywhere. A trillion neutrinos passes through your fingernail, each of your fingernails, every second.
Yeah.
1 trillion neutrinos through each of our fingernails per second. No other particle is even close to having the abundance of neutrinos. And yet we now know that they come in 3 different types. And they change from one type to another.
Now, how do we know that if they're so small?
First, we were puzzled by it. When neutrinos were first detected, we were only detecting 1/3 of the neutrinos that all theory showed should be coming from the sun. The sun's fusion factory at its core produces neutrinos. That's part of it. But only 1/3 of them were being found.
Mm-hmm.
And we could only detect one type of neutrino. Now, it turned out that the missing neutrino problem was due to neutrinos changing into other types of neutrinos, the type that we couldn't detect. And who would have guessed that? Imagine if you were Ray here and then you turn into Bill as you walk down the street and ended up being Jim when you got home. And that's what they do. So this whole realm, and almost harkens back to our previous caller, see, our logic system, of course, our intellect, math, science, logic system was originally based on macroscopic things we could sink our teeth into.
Yeah.
It helps us if we're searching for our underwear or ordering a cheeseburger or any of the things in life. But the realm of the microscopic, and it seems now the realm of the macroscopic, acts in ways that lies outside of our logical systems. Now, a lot of people hate this because it means that our tools for understanding the universe at large are inadequate currently to the task.
Okay. I mean,
you could say that maybe there are other states of awareness. You know, Ray always rolls his eyes if we ever...
I'm not rolling my eyes. I'm just, you know...
As well you should. A good scientist doesn't go for this fuzzy Woodstocky stuff about other states of consciousness and
believe me, I've been in other states of consciousness right around the 20 break and the 40 break. I have no idea what the heck's going on. No, continue.
Right. So
I'm not rolling my eyes. They're rolling back in my head. So. Continue.
But modern cosmology, you know, we're used to people talking about the Big Bang, and people even say, well, what preceded that? And some people actually give answers on television, you know, the Morgan Freeman shows about the universe. And they say, well, we don't yet fully understand it, but the Big Bang could have been this, and it could have been preceded by this. And some are now saying that the universe may be infinite. And at some point, somebody has got to step in and say, an infinite universe cannot be understood logically. It cannot be pictured. Nobody knows what caused the Big Bang. Nobody can conceive of what preceded it. In other words, our universe springing out of nothingness. How? So we actually live in a very non-logical universe when it comes to the basics. The basics meaning, to what extent does it have? How was it born? What's it made of? The basic questions that any kid would ask are not currently answerable.
So does that mean then that everyone in science should just give it up?
No. Fortunately, we're great at the parts. Like if somebody says, well, what's Mars made of? What are the minerals? What's its geology like? I mean, we understand what makes the stars shine.
Yeah.
The nuclear fusion process, these are huge things. So when it comes to the parts of things, we're great, and it's never been a more exciting time to be into science. I don't want to sound pessimistic. I'm only talking about when you look at the universe as a whole, which is the province of cosmology, or when you look at the microscopic, submicroscopic areas of quantum physics, and you get into that realm, you start to get into non-logical realms.
Now, is it non-logical, or is it just that we don't have the foundation of information to make it seem logical? In other words, they always say, if a real alien showed up and they were a million years advanced, everything they did would appear magical to us.
Right, but, right, of course. Technology 100 years from now would be indistinguishable from magic.
Right. And so if, in fact, is it non-logical or is it just that we don't know?
Well,
this
what
stuff
would
we
you
don't
say,
know?
Going back to the example of an electron that takes a certain, that starts out here and gets there, and when you probe what path it took, and you only have two paths available to it, and it could not have taken path A, it could not have taken path B.
So I say there was path C we don't know about.
It could not have, it can't be, because when you block A and B, it doesn't get there. So you know it had to be on one of those two paths. You put in a barrier on both, and it doesn't arrive at the detector. So you know it had to take A and B. But when you actually do experiments to see where it is, you see it wasn't on A, it wasn't on B, it wasn't on neither, and it wasn't on both. And those are the only four choices that we can conceive of. So it's not a matter of getting more information, I think. It's a matter of something happens that lies beyond our ways of thinking.
So we're not conceiving, you said something we can't conceive of. We're not conceiving yet. In other words, we're not capable of making that leap.
Right.
So how do we make the leap?
I don't know.
All right, let's make one more caller here. Sola in Olive Ridge, you're on. You got about a minute, okay?
Okay, hey guys. What a great show. This is the best show I've ever heard. Very synchronistic.
Wow.
Okay, I wanted to say that I wanted to find out, Bob, you're way more open-minded than I ever realized. I apologize. I tend to be a skeptic myself, I guess. But how do you quantify faith in terms of needing proof for something before you can acknowledge it?
A proof of what? are you speaking?
Proof of the fact that, you know, you can postulate that, okay, I don't have proof for these things, but they might exist. I mean, because you said that it's almost not worth spending time with if you can't, you know, follow the antecedent to, you know, something, a concrete answer, maybe.
Well, with some ideas, ideas are ideas. You know, people throw out ideas that this could have happened for the Big Bang, this could have happened, and it's easy to say this could have or maybe this happened, but if you have no evidence, no observation, no way to test it, and string theory is unfortunately like that, then you're just with mental ideas, and they have a certain value, I suppose. But it's good to have some, you know, maybe I'm old-fashioned when it comes to science, but where I come from, it's good to have some observation, ability to test,
yep,
or a way to make it falsifiable, to tell whether it's true or not.
Well, what a cracking show today. Bob Berman was our guest. His book is The Sun's Heartbeat. It's now out in paperback. Support for WAMC comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Identity Eyewear, it's what sets you apart. EYEDENTITY Eyewear.net. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. Richards Fuel and Heating, East Hampton, Massachusetts, providing high-efficiency gas and oil heating systems to the Pioneer Valley for over 45 years, now expanding into the Westfield area, richardsfuel.com. And the Garrison in the Hudson Highlands, featuring an 18-hole golf course, restaurants and terrace dining, weddings, getaway packages, and Hudson River views, thegarrison.com. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Bruce Herbach answered the phones. I'm Ray Graff, and stay tuned now for a news update.